Hi, everybody. My name is Rose, and I am an alcoholic. And I have my phone here just so I can keep track of time. That clock is really far off, because I'll talk forever. First of all, I want to thank Annie for asking me to speak here tonight. I spoke here about 2 years ago, and I can't tell you what it means to me to have an opportunity to share my experience, strength, and hope in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it also, what a wonderful opportunity to see so many young people. This is a program I needed for most of my life. I probably could have used it after any time after the age of 14, but that wasn't my journey. My journey was very different. I mean, it is an honor and a privilege to get an opportunity to tell you a little bit about who I am. Alcoholics Anonymous is a program that I love, and I never thought that I would feel that way. I never wanted to get sober. It wasn't my plan. It wasn't my intention. There's a part in the big book where it talks about becoming a spiritual person, living a spiritual life, or dying an alcoholic death. And I was quite satisfied to die an alcoholic death. I was hopeless, and I didn't see a way out. I couldn't imagine my life without alcohol or drugs. I just couldn't. And I had decided in the worst hour that the only way out for me was to die. I never thought that I would be able to live a day without a drink or a drug. So it's a privilege to stand here tonight and share a little bit about who I am with you. My sobriety date is January 12, 2001. I have a sponsor. I have a home group. It's called Step in the Right Direction in Arapica, which is in Spring Hill, which is about 40 miles away from here. And I try to live the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous in my daily life. I've done them, but I try to live them because that's what seems to work for me. I'm also grateful for anybody over the age of 40 in this room, because looking at, you think I'm kidding, Raj, I'm not kidding, but because I come in here and I automatically feel very, very old, but anyway, having said that, I'm going to tell you a little bit about who I am. I'm 47 years old. I'm originally from New Jersey. I come from an Irish Catholic family. I have two older brothers and a younger sister, and alcohol was always part of my life. My mother is originally from Scotland, of Irish parents, and anytime my family got together, there was alcohol involved. It's not important to me who was an alcoholic, who wasn't an alcoholic. There's alcoholism on both sides of my family, but I am so absolutely certain that that didn't matter. Nobody in my family said, Rose, I hope you grow up and become an alcoholic. So it doesn't matter if my father drank too much or my uncle was an alcoholic. I made a choice at some point in my life to live differently. But alcohol to me was also, it equated a social event. I'd watch my aunts and uncles drink, and I'd watch them get a little looser and a little happier, and they'd start to sing. So for me, I always thought that that's what you did. That's what you were supposed to do when you got together. And especially for somebody like me, I was a very painfully shy child. I mean, painfully shy. I used to hide behind my mom in public and just hold on to her dress because I was petrified somebody would say hello to me. And my two older brothers were just, they were so well balanced. They were handsome and athletic, and they were popular. And growing up, I just wasn't those things. I was overweight. I had bright red hair. And 40 years ago, bright red hair was not something anybody had. I was that fat redhead, you know. So I just never felt comfortable in my skin. My skin never fit. I was depressed and sad long before I ever picked up a drink. I just never felt good enough, smart enough, pretty enough. I never felt anything good. And the feelings I had were so absolutely overwhelming for me that I was a bit of a social misfit. When I was 9 years old, my parents had another child. They had my little sister. And I come from a good family, but both of my parents worked. And so at the age of nine, I came home from school, and I had an infant to take care of and do my homework and start dinner. So I was an old lady before I even hit double digits. You know, I was just an old soul and a sad girl. But when I found alcohol, I found the solution to all of my problems. I remember the very first time I drank. I was 14 years old, and I drank before a high school dance. And I went to high school with both of my brothers, which made my life equally more difficult because they were everything, and I was nothing, and I was just their little sister. I never had an identity of my own. I was Isabel's daughter. I was Tommy's little sister. I was Katie's sister. I was never Rose. Rose was a nobody. Rose was a wallflower. Rose was just so desperate to fit in somewhere. So that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a part of something. And that's what everybody did. They drank, they smoked, they smoked a little weed, whatever. And I was so desperate to just fit in. So I begged my brother to buy me a six-pack of beer before high school dance, and he said he didn't think that was a good idea. And I said, well, that's what you do. That's what your friends do. And eventually, after I bugged him enough, he gave in, and he bought that beer for me. And what I remember most is after I drank those three beers, is all of those feelings that I'd always felt. I didn't feel anymore. Alcohol changed my perception of the world around me. I didn't feel like I was not pretty enough, or not smart enough, or not funny enough, or not popular enough. I felt normal for the first time in my life. I drank to feel normal. I didn't drink socially ever. From the first drink I ever took, I drank to get drunk. I never had a period of time in my life where I was a social drinker. My drinking was bad from the start. I've heard speakers share their story, and they have these funny stories. I don't have them. Almost immediately, from the time I started drinking, it was bad. By the age of 15, I had my first bout of alcohol poisoning, had to be rushed to the hospital, had to jumpstart my heart. And most people would say, wow, you know what? Maybe you ought to knock this off. You don't do it very well. Not me. I thought, well, maybe I shouldn't drink the whole bottle of vodka straight down next time. I'll pace myself a little better. I'll eat a little something before I drink. By the time I was 16, I was going to bars every day. I went to 12 years of Catholic school, and I left school and I went to the bar. By the time I was 17, my father sat me down and was one of those parent-child things where they look at you over the long dining room table. And my father said to me, Rose, you have all the earmarks of being an alcoholic. And I knew he was right. And my dad was a bartender. And if he knew anything, he knew his daughter was an alcoholic and his daughter had a serious problem. And as much as I knew my father was right, I had absolutely no intention of stopping. It was my answer. My drinking might be your problem, but it was my solution. And under no circumstance could I see living life without a drink or drug in my hand. I just couldn't see that. So I knew the old man was right, but who cares? At 17, I know everything. I mean, I have the answers to all of the world's problems. And it's my life, and I'm going to live it any way that I want to. And that was my vow from that point forward. I just had to be smarter about it. I had to come in a little later or a little quieter. You know, I just had to hide it better. So that's when you become a genius at manipulation and hiding things. And that's what I did. By the time I graduated high school, I decided to go to a county college in my area. And then I realized about 2 months in, I wasn't interested. Alcohol and drugs took away my motivation. They took away my desire to ever do anything more than was absolutely required of me. I was never a dumb kid. I got good grades in school. I always thought of myself as a pretty bright person, but I just didn't want to do it anymore. I wanted to go to the bars. I wanted to play pool. I wanted to hang out. I wanted to dance. I never played pool. I never danced. I drank. That's what I did. I used to think that I learned how to play pool until I actually tried in sobriety, and I realized I have no idea what I'm doing. And then I thought, well, maybe I never really did. There's a whole decade in my life that I'm not really sure of. So it could have been during that decade. I'm not positive. But that's what I did. I dropped out of school, and I decided to work full time. And as much of an alcoholic as I am, I'm also a workaholic. I will work, 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 because I love things. I love shoes. I love pocketbooks. I love clothes. I love jewelry. I love all that stuff. So I worked as hard as I drank. And by the time I was 20, not only was I an everyday full-blown alcoholic, I probably was a full-blown alcoholic by the time I was 17, actually. I was also a blackout drinker. If I had one drink, I couldn't tell you what happened. And not that it was ever just one drink, but as soon as I took that first one, it was lights out. It was so bad, I used to write notes to myself about what I did, who I said, who I called. So the next day, I would know what I did. And then I couldn't read my handwriting, so I still didn't know. And it's embarrassing. So after a while, you get tired of your friends saying to you, do you know what you did last night? Do you know where your car's parked? Do you know? And I'd be like, big question mark, big blank. And it got too humiliating for me to drink socially anymore, so I started becoming a hermit alcoholic. Around the same time, I met a man. And the thing that attracted me to this man was that he drank like I did. I didn't feel awkward with him because he drank with a purpose. He drank to get drunk, and that's what I did. I was never a little sipper. I mean, I drank. You know, I never liked bar drinks anyway because, quite frankly, you go and you pay $8 or $9 for a drink this big. There's only this much booze in it. Who are you kidding? I got to be here for 3 days to get drunk. I can't drink like that. So I met this man, and we instantly fell in love with each other. because of the mutual alcoholic attraction. The relationship was sick. It was toxic from the very start. But I convinced myself that I was in love. And no matter what, we would be together for always. 2 years into the relationship, his parents met with my parents and said, we better break these two up before they kill each other. And they were right. But again, I was in love and that was never going to happen. So we stayed in there. By the time I was 25, I'd been with him for about 5 years. I was still living at home with mom and dad because it was a good gig. They charged me $20 a week rent. I was working. I was making a lot of money in a very good company. And I was able to shop and live any way that I wanted. So who would want to give that up? But my parents decided to move here to Florida, and they threw me out in the street at the age of 25. So I decided to move in with this man. I was already an alcoholic, already drank every day. But as soon as I moved in with him, the amount of alcohol that I started to consume probably tripled. Because I didn't have to hide it anymore. I didn't have to sneak around anymore. I had free range to do whatever I wanted. At that point, I started drinking about 1.75 liters of whiskey every night. And I did that for many, many, many years. Soon after I moved in with him, he stopped working altogether. And I became the sole provider. And that's okay, because Rose settles for everything in her life. Good enough is good enough for Rose. So I continued to support him, and he started to become abusive. It started with psychological abuse and verbal abuse, and it moved on to sexual abuse, and finally the physical abuse. And for a long time, I was so sick that I believed the things that he would say to me. I believed him when he told me he would kill me. I believed him when he told me he would hurt my family. And I couldn't see a way out. I was trapped in this relationship. And I hated him. But I kept buying him booze. And he was a very sick alcoholic. And he used to try to get sober every so often. He would say, I'm going to go away. And he'd go to a detox for a couple of days. And he would come out. And sure enough, I never stopped drinking because I wasn't the one with the problem. See, my life wasn't unmanageable. I was absolutely certain that I was an alcoholic. That was not a question. I knew it. I was fine with that. It's okay, so I'm an alcoholic, so what? I never got the unmanageability part of my life. I never got that because to me, my life was manageable. I got up every day and I went to work. I made a good living. I made a lot of money so I could write a check. I could buy you a present to forgive me. I could buy you a present as insurance for the next time I screwed up. So I didn't see. If you make money and you have the right appearance and you drive the right car, you can hide behind that facade of having a good quality life for a very long period of time, and that's what I did. And I was absolutely certain that my life would be okay if this man would just get his shit together. I really, really thought that if he would just fix himself, that everything else would be fine. So one of these times he decided to go to a rehab, and I thought, well, that's good. You know, you really have a problem. And he came out, and he said to me, I'd like to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'd like for you to go with me. Well, you've got to be kidding me, right? But anyway, I said, okay, I'm going to go, because that's what a good woman does. That's what a good, supportive woman does. And that was my very first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was 25 years old, and it was at a hospital in the town where we were living. And I remember walking into this meeting, and it was a speaker meeting. And it was in a cafeteria. And I remember sitting down, and, oh, God, I just felt so uncomfortable. The hair on the back of my neck stood up, and I was sure everybody was staring at me. And you know how alcoholics are. Ugh, they want to say hello and touch you and all that other stuff. And so I sat down, and all of a sudden this woman started sharing. Her name was Debbie B. And I got it. I didn't realize at that time it was my very first identification with another alcoholic. She started telling my story. She started talking about being abused. She started talking about never feeling good enough or worthy enough. She started talking about all those feelings that I drank over my whole life. And I sat there sobbing. And that's probably why at the end of the meeting she came up to me and she said, you know what? You don't have to live this way anymore. There's a better way. And she did what we're supposed to do. She put her hand out there. She put the hand of AA out there, and she tried to help me. She became my sponsor. She made suggestions of me, like, don't drink and go to meetings. Well, I drank and went to meetings. She'd say, just for today, Rose. And God, she tried so hard to help me, but I just wasn't willing. I just wasn't ready. She convinced me I should go away to rehab, and I did. I went away to a very nice little luxury rehab in New Jersey for 28 days, and I think I got a chip at the end that said, you'll never drink again, woohoo. And when I left there, I stayed sober for about 2 months. But I didn't do any of the things people suggested. I didn't get a sponsor. I didn't put myself in the program. I stayed around the program. I didn't do what they told me to do. And sure enough, I started drinking again, and he started drinking again. But what I never did was I never told my family in Florida that I had relapsed. And for the next 10 years, I let them believe I was sober. And it's easy when your family lives 1,200 miles away. You just don't call them when you're drunk. You call everybody else when you're drunk, but you don't call them. And so this went on, and when I would come down here to Florida for a visit, I just wouldn't drink in front of them. And if it got really, really bad, I'd wait till they went to bed, and I'd have a bottle hidden in the spare bedroom, and I'd drink in the room by myself, because that's how I'm used to drinking anyway. What's the difference? And eventually I'd only be able to stay for a week or so. That's as much as I could tolerate, and then I'd go back home. Well, the abuse with this man just started getting worse and worse and worse, and I knew that I had to leave him. I knew that that my life was just never going to get any better if I was with him. And I was almost there. I almost had enough strength to walk away from him because I was so sick. I didn't have the ability to realize that all those things that I swore I'd never done, I was doing. I couldn't tell the truth from the false anymore. I was so muddled and enmeshed in my own addiction and so codependent that I couldn't make the break. I couldn't save myself. But I got there. I was just about ready to do it. And he fell down a flight of stairs and he broke his neck. And he became partially paralyzed. And now I felt trapped. I couldn't leave him. What kind of a good woman would leave a man when he's at his worst? I couldn't do it. So I didn't. I stayed with him for, I think it was a year or two. I honestly am unclear on some of the dates in my my drinking time. More will be revealed, and it has been, but I'm still not clear. I stayed with him for about another year, and I just couldn't take it anymore. And, of course, he kept drinking because I bought him the booze. Because I bought him the booze because I thought if I kept him just a little bit drunk, that he wouldn't beat me anymore. Because as sick as he was and as physically handicapped as he was still incredibly violent. So I used alcohol as a weapon to control him. I used to buy sleeping pills. And I would come home at night and I would crush him. And I would put him in his drink to try and pass him out, so he would pass out. I never realized when I was doing that I probably could have killed him. I was just trying to buy a peaceful night for myself. Eventually, he got very, very sick. He used to have GI bleeds where his esophagus, the veins in his esophagus would bleed, and he was rushed to the hospital. And my mother just happened to come from Florida to New Jersey to visit me, and she could see how sick I was, how broken I was. And she attributed it to the physical violence that I was enduring my home. I never told my parents, but I did not know that every time the cops come to your house that it's printed in the newspaper. And I did not know that my brothers would call my mother and father up and let them know he did it again. And when they would ask me, I would lie. So my mother knew, but she never knew because I told her. She knew because she was given the information from other people. So she could see how shattered I was. And she said, this has got to end. And all I know is that we went to the hospital to visit him, and when we walked out, he was no longer in my life. My mother broke up with him. And that was it. So now my life's going to get better. I'm 33 years old. I'd been with this man for 13 years. And now it's going to get better because he's gone. And I blamed him for 13 years for everything that was wrong with my life. And what I realized was that he was gone and nothing changed. I was still sick. I was still lonely. I was still angry. I was still depressed. I was still fearful. I was still all of those things. And I didn't have anybody to blame anymore. And I was still drinking. And I would try to stop drinking, and sometimes I would be able to for a day or two, but I'd always pick it back up again because I missed the ease and the comfort that alcohol provides me. And I was so, so lonely. And there were times, I remember, I used to work long days. I'd work like 10, 12-hour days, and I'd get in my car after work, and I would drive home, and I'd say, don't stop at the liquor store, Rose. Just don't stop, don't stop, don't stop. And I couldn't not stop. I'd be in the parking lot, and I'd say, just don't go in. And I couldn't not go in. And I said, just don't buy the bottle, don't buy it. And I'd buy four. And I'd get home and I'd pour the drink. And sometimes I would stare at a drink for half an hour. Don't drink it, don't drink it, don't drink it. And I had to. I'd lost my ability to choose. And sometimes I'd drink the drink down and I'd throw it right back up and I'd drink it down again. And I'm the type of alcoholic where I didn't ever sleep, I passed out. I wet the bed every night and I threw up every morning for 20 years. I'm a very sick alcoholic, and yet I never, for a minute, could imagine my life without it. I was so lonely at this point in my life, and I knew the problem was alcohol. I knew the problem was that I needed to stop drinking, but I didn't want to, and I didn't know how to, and I certainly wasn't going back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I could never have imagined myself being involved in a cult like that. Because certainly, you're not that happy if you're not drinking and drugging. So got to be drinking little cups of Kool-Aid after the meeting, because if I was that happy, I'd have to kill myself. So I'm not going back there. So I knew that something had to change, but I didn't know what. And I would try to fill that hole in my soul with everything. I love to shop. I love to do all kinds of stuff like that. I tried to fill that hole with men, with money, with clothing, with anything, and nothing was working. So I tried to become a little bit more social because I'd been so closed off from the world. All I did was work and drink for 20 years that I thought maybe if I went out, tried to have some friends, maybe that would help. So one of my friends asked me if I would like to go out for some drinks with them, and I didn't do that. I wasn't a social drinker anymore because I couldn't drink the way I wanted to socially. I had really believed for a really long time that nobody knew I was an alcoholic because I did it in the privacy of my own home. I didn't realize that when you drink that much whiskey, chances are you probably still stink the next day at work, but I thought if I sprayed enough stuff on me, nobody knew. And maybe some people didn't know, but I'm sure some people did. But for whatever reason, on this particular night, I decided to go out, and that's something I didn't do. And it was the night before Thanksgiving. It was 1998. And I didn't know, because I was 33, I was fairly old at that point, that the night before Thanksgiving is a big night out in the bars. I didn't know that. I didn't know kids come home from school and they go out to party. Didn't know. So I agreed to meet my friends at a bar, and of course, being the good alcoholic I am, I had to have drinks before I went to the bar, and something else maybe or whatever before I went. And by the time I got there, it was late. It was probably 9 o'clock at night, and I instantly was not having a good time. Absolutely instantly. And that's because I wasn't able to drink the way I wanted to drink. I couldn't get drunk. And that makes me unhappy. Because that's what I do. That's who I am. So I stayed for a couple of hours and I said, you know what? I'm going to head out of here. I got to go home. Tomorrow's Thanksgiving. And I knew I had to get to my brother's house for Thanksgiving and have the whole family thing. So I knew I had to get home and get drunk, pass out and get up and get sick and make myself look halfway presentable before I went to Thanksgiving dinner, because of course nobody knows I'm an alcoholic. So that was my plan, and never for a minute when I left the bar that night did I think that I was in no condition to drive. I'm a professional alcoholic. I've been doing this for 20 years. I had a couple of drinks. I wasn't drunk. Not in my opinion. So never did I think, wow, Rose, you really shouldn't drive. You shouldn't put the key in the ignition. You shouldn't drive. Never even crossed my mind. So I started to drive home, and I almost made it the whole way home. I lived 18 miles from the bar. Or actually, it was like 17.3, something like that. And I was literally around the corner from my apartment. And I was smoking a cigarette at the time, and I dropped my cigarette. And when I bent over to pick it up, I hit something. And I lived in a really rural part of northwest New Jersey. A lot of farmland, a lot of deer, no streetlights, no sidewalks, just really country kind of environment. And I firmly, absolutely, honestly, from my soul, believed that I hit a deer. But I also knew I'd been drinking. I also knew I had other things in my car that I shouldn't have had. And the police department was about 100 yards down on the left-hand side, because that's how my life is. And I didn't stop. And I continued, turned the corner, parked my car in the parking lot, and went into my apartment. It was raining torrentially that night, and I was talking to a friend of mine, and I said, you know what, I hit a deer on the way home tonight, and my windshield shattered. And I was so worried that the interior of my car was going to get damaged. I said, do you have anything I could cover my windshield with? And he said, I got a tarp in the garage, Rose, I'll bring it over. And sure enough, within 10 minutes, he pulled into the parking lot, and I walked outside with him to cover my windshield. When we went to put the tarp over it, in the passenger side corner was a tuft of hair and a chunk of a human forehead. And I panicked. I said, oh my God, take me back. And he did. He drove me literally. We turned out of my parking lot and we turned the corner and I could see the police cars. And I could see the ambulance. And I knew that I didn't hit a deer. And I panicked. I said, oh my God, take me back home. Because I didn't want to get this guy in trouble. But the truth of the matter is I was paralyzed with fear. I didn't know what to do. I knew I was in trouble. They don't call an ambulance for a deer. So I said, take me home. And he did. And he dropped me off. And being the good alcoholic that I am, I went inside and I continued to drink. I never hid my car. I never ran. I waited. I was absolutely certain that the police were going to find me. And a couple hours later, there was a knock on my door. And it was the police department. And they said, Miss Eshman, it appears as though your vehicle's been in an accident. We need to bring you in for questioning. And after 5 hours of questioning, they told me that I'd struck and killed a 45-year-old man that had been walking in the road. and I didn't see him because I didn't stop. A very good friend of mine bailed me out of the police department that night. I never even saw the county jail. And I knew my life absolutely would never be the same. So I went on a mission to kill myself because that's the only way out. When you get into this kind of trouble, there's no hope. You have to kill yourself because that's the only answer. And that's what I intended to do. My family, of course, is now aware that I've been drinking. They're aware that I've taken someone's life. And they make a couple of suggestions to me. They said, Rosa, you need to get an attorney and you need to seek some psychiatric help because you're in bad shape. And I was. And I did both those things. I got an attorney and I turned myself into a psychiatric ward where they locked me up for 11 days. And then they told me, you know what? I don't think you can be by yourself. And they put me in a residential housing, a crisis house for adults. And I stayed there for about a month or so. And I proceeded to have an affair with my counselor. And he became my higher power. The day I was released, I tried to go back to work. And I realized I couldn't do it anymore. I couldn't do the simple things in my life. I couldn't take a shower. I couldn't brush my teeth. I couldn't get over what I'd done. I used to get in my car and I used to go to the scene of the accident, sometimes six times a day. And I used to just look at it and say, how could I have done this? How could my life have gotten to this point? And I said, well, how could it have not gotten to this point? I've been like a train wreck waiting to happen my whole life. So I became more convinced and more determined than ever that the only way out was suicide, and I kept trying. I tried at least four different times. A couple of times I signed myself in. A couple of times they told me, you're not leaving. And eventually, this man that tried to rescue me, tried to save me, said, you can't stay here anymore, Rose. And I had nowhere else to go, and I came to Florida. I was on bail, awaiting trial, and I decided to take my case to trial only for one reason. I really thought that if I could walk into a courtroom and I could let this victim's family see me, and I could say that I was sorry, that it wouldn't be so bad, I could get rid of that blackness in my soul. But it took 2.5 years to get my case to trial. And after this man threw me out and I had nowhere to go, I came down here to Florida and I stayed with my parents. And I became more determined than ever that the only way out for me was suicide. And my parents made it absolutely impossible for me to drink. Because the only way I have enough courage to kill myself is if I'm drunk. And I'll drink anything, I'll take anything, and that was my plan. One of the saddest memories I ever have is I remember sneaking out to a liquor store when I was living with my parents. And there was like a quarter mile this way. Of course, I walked 9 miles the other way to the liquor store because I didn't know. And on the way back, I remember walking in the house and my father taking my duffel bag, taking out the bottle of whiskey, and I remember watching him pour it down the drain. And I remember just sobbing. Because what am I supposed to do? I couldn't stand how I felt anymore. I just wanted it over. My brother-in-law had started going to Alcoholics Anonymous. He had a bad drug problem and a drinking problem, and he'd found recovery. And he'd come to my parents' house for dinner. And he said probably the worst thing he's ever said to me in my life. We were sitting at the dinner table, and he said, Rose, I'm going to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous tonight. Would you like to come? And I never hated him more than I hated him at that moment. And I looked at him, and my father looked at me, and he said, baby, I don't think you have a choice. So I went to my very first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in Florida. I couldn't pick my head up. I couldn't make eye contact with anybody. And the most I could get out of my mouth was, my name is Rose, and I'm an alcoholic. And I cried every day for 3 weeks. That's all I could do was cry. I couldn't talk. I couldn't do anything but cry. But I kept going. Every night he picked me up, and he dragged me to a meeting, and I kept going, and I kept going. And eventually I started to feel a little bit better. My head started to clear a little bit. And I got a little flicker of hope, just a little, that maybe I could get through all this stuff that's going to happen in my life, because it's going to be bad. It's going to be real bad. But unfortunately, I got back involved with the man that I'd been with in New Jersey, and I started making trips back and forth to be with him, because I'm always in love. I was in love. And I got a call from my sister on one of these trips to New Jersey, and I had remained sober, that my father was in very bad shape, and I came back to Florida, and within a month my father had died. But thank God I was able to do and say the things I was supposed to do and say with my father, and I was sober at the time of his death, which I never would have been had my life not gone the way that it went. So I'm grateful, if nothing else, for that. But after we buried my father, and I helped my mother straighten out her affairs and do all that stuff. I decided to go back to New Jersey because I was getting ready to go to trial in January, and it was October. And I wanted to spend the last few months of my freedom with this man because I knew I wasn't just going to walk away in a courtroom. I knew my future was going to be different. So I decided to go back to New Jersey, and I don't think my feet were on the ground. I don't think I was off the plane for 5 minutes when I started drinking again. And I also knew, but I never admitted, that I was pregnant. Because I didn't know how to break that one to this guy. That's pretty serious. You know, you're about to go on trial for your life, and now you're pregnant, and talk about a screw-up. If somebody can do something wrong, it's going to be me. So I continued to drink, and I continued to do other things, and eventually he said to me, Rose, if you drink one more time, I'm putting you on a plane. He went to work, I went to the liquor store. It's a no-brainer. You're not going to tell me not to do it. I'm going to do it. Sure enough, the next morning I was at Newark Airport, hungover, like there's no tomorrow, and he put me on a plane. He spent $750 to send me one way. He wanted rid of me that bad. And I remember my sister picked me up at Tampa International Airport, and she asked me how I was, and I said, I'm drunk, and she said, I can see that. And I said, and I think I'm pregnant. It's the only time I ever admitted it to anybody. When I got back here to Florida, I went to Alcoholics Anonymous every single day, and I got drunk after every single meeting. And I cannot tell you how painful it is to be in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and to know that you are a liar, to know that you can't look anybody in the eye, you can't share, because you're a liar. The duality of that is incredibly painful. I mean, AA really does ruin your drinking, but I just sat there because I didn't know what else to do. I just kept coming, and I kept coming, but I kept drinking, and I kept drinking. Eventually, in January of 2001, I went back to New Jersey to stand trial. After 3 weeks of trial, during which I miscarried, which is a blessing. It's just a blessing. But the soul sickness that I felt, being on trial for killing one man and then knowing I'm responsible for taking the life of an innocent child, was overwhelming for me. I couldn't pick my head up during my trial. I couldn't look at anybody. I was a mess. And after 3 weeks, I was found guilty. And they sent me to the county jail, to await my sentencing. And I could have been bonded out at that point. And I remember calling my mother from the holding cell. And I was convicted of three crimes. I was convicted of death by auto, which is a violent crime in New Jersey. I was convicted of leaving the scene of an accident and possession of less than 50 milligrams of CDS. And I remember calling my mother from the holding cell. Now, mind you, in a three-month period of time, she's lost her husband and now her daughter's in jail waiting to go to prison. And I remember saying, please get me out. Please get me out. And she'd say, I'm not getting you out. And I'd hang up the phone. I'd call her again. Get me out. Please get me out. If this was one of your sons, you'd get him out of jail. And I remember her coming to the county jail. And my mother's 4'11". And I remember her looking at me through the two-way glass. And she said, Rosellen, I love you, but I'm going to save your life. I'm not getting you out of jail. And she let me sit there for 4.5 months until I was sentenced. And when I got sentenced to 12 years and 30 days in the state facility. I had three consecutive sentences, not even concurrent. I had a 5-year sentence, a 7-year sentence, and a 30-day sentence. And 8 days after I was sentenced, I was sent to the only female correctional facility in the state of New Jersey. And I'll never forget the feeling I had when I walked in there. And they slam that gate behind you. I thought, I'll never survive this. I don't belong here. I'm not like these people. But I am. You see, I made a choice that had a consequence, and that's the consequence of the choice. For the first 3 years of my sentence, I was in the maximum security part of the prison because in New Jersey, my crime is a violent crime. My car was my weapon. So I was there with the most heinous criminals you can imagine, and I was pissed off, and I was angry. And never once did I think that I wouldn't drink again. Never once did I say, wow, look at where your life has gone, Rose. Maybe you should think about giving up the drink and giving up the drugs. But I didn't. I planned. In 12 years and 30 days, I will drink this. This is where I will hide it. This is how I will get it. I never once thought that drinking was not going to be part of my life. After 3 years, I was allowed to get a different classification, and I went to the minimum security part of the prison. And when I got there, there was a program available called Puppies Behind Bars. And in the maximum security part of this prison, there was no life. There was barbed wire and dirt. But when I got to this other part of the prison, there was flowers and trees, and I could see the highway, and I could see cars, things I hadn't seen in 3 years. And I decided, well, maybe I should get involved with this program. It was working with dogs. I hadn't seen a dog in years. So I thought it would be good for me. It would help get me out of my own way. It would help distract me. It helped me do my time a little bit easier. And I did. I got involved, and I started working with dogs, and I realized, oh, my God, I love this. And after about 4 months, they handed me my first puppy to raise. It was an 8-week-old black Labrador retriever named Sandy. And the minute they put that puppy in my arms, it changed my life. For the first time in years, I felt love. I hadn't felt love because I put huge walls around me to protect me from everything. And inside those walls is all those horrible things that I'm trying to protect myself from. It's the fear, it's the rage, it's the loneliness, it's the anger, it's the depression. It's all in there with me. I didn't get that. And this dog just started to melt those walls. Because she loved me. She didn't care what I did, she loved me. Didn't matter what I looked like, she loved me. She just wanted me to feed her. She loved me. And it gave me hope. A friend of mine had come from Florida to see me in prison when I was in the maximum security part, and she'd brought me all this AA material, which of course I had no use for. So I promptly put it in a bin and under my bed, and I decided to pull it out. And I thought, well, maybe there's hope. Maybe I can live a different way. Maybe some of this stuff might work for me. And I started going to meetings in prison. Eventually, I was up for parole after I served a little over 6 years, and I was granted parole down here in Florida. I got to come here via the Interstate Compact. I'm still currently on parole. My parole time is 4.5 years. I will be off of it next May. My life today is beyond my wildest dreams. I have a sponsor who held my hand, who walked me through the steps, who showed me how to trust her so I could learn how to trust myself. The life I have today is a life I don't deserve. I've been allowed to do things that people told me I would never be allowed to do. I have a relationship with a higher power now, and that's really what it's all about for me. I have come to the conclusion in my recovery that as long as I'm right with my higher power, the rest of my life works out. It's about me and God, and that's it. If I'm right with God, I'm right with the world. I only have a couple of minutes here, so I'll try to sum it up quickly. If I can give you nothing else tonight, I want to give you hope. I never wanted this life. I never thought I could stop drinking. I never thought that I deserved anything. But I've learned that I do. I've learned that the freedom that I have now today is unbelievable, and I never thought not drinking could give me freedom, but it does. The promises have come true in my life. I do know a new freedom and a new happiness. I don't regret my past or wish to shut the door on it. I do want to help another person because that helps me. I'm so grateful that I didn't get what I deserve because I can't even imagine what that would have been like. I just recently had an opportunity to carry the message into the prison where I live. I was told I would never be able to do that. And yet, God had a different plan for me, and I'm able to take the message into prison where it's so absolutely needed. That brings me greater joy than I can possibly explain to you. To look in the eyes of the women, and I know exactly how they feel because I sat in their seats. If you're new or coming back, hang in there. It gets better, I promise you. The life I have today is beyond my wildest dreams. I have self-esteem today, which I never had. I have a relationship with a man that I love. And I never thought that that was possible for me. I recently welcomed into our family my fiancé, son. He's come to live with us. So for all you people who thought that was my date, I'm not a cougar. He's my fiancé, son. So poor Vincent. But in closing, I just really want to say this, because this guy's going to yank me off in a minute. I just want to say this. He is. He keeps splashing things at me. Anyway, I told you I talk. Anyway, AA works for me. It's the only thing that's ever held my attention. And the reason it gets to me is because your heart speaks to my heart. That's the only thing that has ever worked for me. My sponsor used to say, don't quit before the miracle happens. And I never got it until the miracle happened. Give yourself time. That's the one thing I would never give myself is time. I was drank or drugged before the time because it got too painful for me. All the alcohol, the drugs is going to do is just change your perception of what it is. It's not going to change what that is. I could have a pile of shit on the floor right next to me, and I could say, ooh, that's a pile of poop. And I could drink it. I'm saying, that's not so bad. But it's still a pile of poop. The drink just changes your perception. It doesn't change what it is. Keep coming. Don't leave. Give yourself a chance. Give yourself the one thing that I wouldn't give myself. Time. I promise you, your life will get better. I guarantee you. Stay close to AA. And don't stay around it. Stay in it. And I'm going. Thanks for letting me share.